Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you very much, as always, for being here. We are, of course, in the middle of an interlull, but I have to say, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is the lowest and 10 is the most interlullish of interlulls, I reckon this is somewhere about, a 4 or a 5. It hasn't felt too bad. I thought it was going to be worse, but there's been bits and pieces going on. Of course, there's the Arsene Wenger movie out. We're going to talk to Philippe Auclair about that and Arsene Wenger a bit later on. There's been some stuff from Mikel Arteta about Arsene Wenger. What else has been happening? Oh, Emile Smith-Rowe has been called up to the England squad for the first time, having been left out. Some withdrawals due to injury and illness have opened up a place for him, so he could win his first England cap during this international break, which is, I think, well-deserved, given how well he has played and how important he's become to Arsenal during, well, not just the last 12 months, but in particular this season and over the last month or so. His contributions have really made a big difference to where we are in the table right now. So that's been great. We found out as well that he's made some lifestyle changes. He doesn't eat as much chocolate. He's cut down on the takeaways and the Nando's. Gotta say, if somebody said to me tomorrow, "You can never eat another Nando's again," I go, "Oh no, you mean I won't be able to have my second ever Nando's after my first one?" Which was like, never eating this again, because it's just not that good. I know there's people out there right now who love their Nando's. I know there are. I'm just hoping that they're not like Beyonce fans or Taylor Swift fans who'll turn on me because I dared to not like mediocre chicken as much as they do. Look, the story here is not Nando's. The story is Emile Smith-Rowe. And let's hope he has a very successful international break and comes back to us ready to pick up where he left off, which of course will mean that he scores, I don't know, 2, 3, what? I'm at 4. Is 4 goals at Anfield too much to ask? Look, if a tiny little Russian who ate Mr. Kipling for breakfast can do it, then I have full faith in Emile Smith-Rowe to match that achievement when we play at Liverpool next weekend. No pressure, though. No pressure. Okay, look, I said a bit later on we're going to be talking to Philippe Auclair. We will be. I'll also give you the winners of the competition from last week in which you can win a copy of the Scouted Football Handbook. We talked to Phil Costa about that. I'll give you the winners of that in a little while as well. Now, though, to talk a bit about Premier League, to talk a bit about some of the stuff that's been going on around players, social media and more. Delighted to welcome back to the show a man we haven't spoken to for some time. He is the chief football writer for the iPaper. It is Daniel Story. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Andrew. You okay?
I'm okay. Thank you very much. I thought we might have some general Premier League chat, but I thought there was an interesting story during the week, maybe over the weekend. I'm sure people have seen it. The Manchester United CEO of media was on a podcast and he spoke about how at Manchester United they look at what's going on with players and the stories, or as he said, the narratives, and how they try and support the various narratives that certain players want to tell, and also, using the word narrative again, countering specific narratives which are fed back to them when they take all the data, and they do the graphs and all that kind of stuff when it comes to, what people are saying about footballers, what people are saying about football clubs. And I guess we all know to some extent, like, a lot of Premier League footballers are footballers, but they're also very brand conscious. They've got teams of people, PR people, social media managers, all of that kind of stuff. And you know, I read it and I thought, well, this is a load of old wank, really. But also, it feels like an inevitability that this kind of thing will become more and more prevalent in football.
Yeah, I mean, it intrinsically feels just about as far away from proper football in inverted commas as you can get. Mm. There are a number of ways in which football in 2021 makes you feel like that, but this was very explicitly detailed, and I presume with Manchester United say so, that he detailed exactly the processes and the strategies that go behind these things. And look, it's one of those things that I think we probably all, as you kind of mentioned, we all probably knew it went on, but it's easier not to kind of look behind the curtain and see how the sausages are made, because it does, on a personal view, it raises a huge amount of cynicism and a kind of sort of depressing inevitability about the whole process. I understand that some footballers won't want to tweet out themselves, partly because, they want to keep that kind of thing separate from themselves, partly because some of them won't feel like they express themselves properly, and they don't want to kind of get caught out by this kind of gotcha culture, maybe. Mm-hmm. To my mind, it does create a kind of inauthentic voice. It does dilute the message they're trying to send, unfortunately. And one of their explanations for that might be, well, every time we tweet anything, we get this barrage of abuse anyway, so why on earth would we want to?
Well, I mean, there is that. And I think we saw some funny stuff as well with the Bruno Fernandes account tweeting out a good vibes tweet with pictures of Mohamed Elneny, Gabriel Martinelli and Emile Smith Rowe. Bit of a whoops there on behalf of the social media managers. I mean, I think there is that as well. Like, if you're a young player, maybe being on social media isn't the best thing for you. I thought it was quite interesting. Martin Odegaard has deleted his Twitter account, saying, "It's a load of crap. You need to be careful what you expose yourself to. I don't need to sit there and see all that. A lot of anonymity and strange things," which I guess is quite diplomatic. "It could be bad and scary if your head is not in the right place." But the prevalence of social media and these platforms and their importance to clubs as marketing tools mean that, this isn't a thing that is going to go away. You can spot when a player account is authentic, usually. You can see the ones that aren't. But, I mean, is there a good way of doing this for football clubs? Is there a non-cynical way of engaging? Even that word itself, engagement, sounds so contrived, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, from a footballer point of view, I can't quite understand the want to do it, or even really the need to do it. I guess for senior pros, there is one eye looking on the rest of their career, and if they seem to offer some insight, that could help in terms of maybe post-career jobs. But other than that, I can't quite see why you'd bother. Depressingly, that abuse, those strange things to which Odegaard refers to, are an inevitability now. There's no getting away from them. And I don't think, unless there's a huge shift in the governance of social media, then I don't think there's that's a Pandora's box that's now opened. I don't think that's going to go away. So I can't see quite what they have to gain out of it. I, the honest answer is I don't know if clubs put pressure on players. I suspect it comes more from their own management to be seen as having a personality and therefore being able to get across maybe tenets of that personality that they want people to understand. But I mean, I'm not a pure just a supporter. I am a writer. I accept that. But as a fan, if I was a Manchester United fan, I don't think I would gain anything out of, for example, Harry Maguire telling me that he was disappointed in a result, or even worse than that, someone writing on Harry Maguire's behalf that he's disappointed about a result and he's going to go again.
Yeah.
These tweets are almost exclusively written in fairly banal media spiel cliches, which I don't really think offers any insight at all, other than, that's exactly what we thought you'd say. If a player has something, I think social media can be used in a really good way if it's done in a kind of humorous, if it really gets across the player's personality. Someone like Mikel Antonio is really good at that. And you can tell it's him, and you can tell that that's his personality coming across. I don't feel like I'm getting anything of E.G. Harry Maguire's personality in those tweets.
No, and look, I think we can look at it as maybe slightly older in the tooth gentlemen to varying to varying degrees and wonder what is the benefit for a footballer to be on social media, but they're also young men, and pretty much everybody has social media. Their teammates have it, other teammates, international teammates, all of that kind of stuff, where you can see actually some good interactions between players and everything else. But at the same time, it does leave you open to, look, we've seen it. We don't need to go over this, Graham, because I don't really have the solution for it. You know, talk of banning anonymous accounts is all well and good, but when there's people quite happy to put their name to their racist tirades and screeds on Twitter in response to a young footballer who missed a penalty in a game of football, you know, no anonymity is going to change that. But it does leave them open to that kind of thing. And I wonder if more and more this is going to have to become, if you like, part of the curriculum at football clubs at academy level, as to, I mean, I think it probably should be on the curriculum in general in the world, you know, for kids to understand how social media operates and the permanency of things that you do online, et cetera, et cetera. But for young players, you know, to understand that, you know, you could be the target of nasty people just because, A, they don't like your club, they don't like what you did for the national team, they don't like the color of your skin, whatever it might be, there's always going to be somebody who could target you.
Yeah, and the magic button with social media that didn't exist beforehand is that it does feel to the person sending those messages as a very personal connection. So that creates the argument for having a PR team to do it for you, in that it allows you to send a message which, you know, cynically, I think is probably diluted because it isn't them, but it does allow them to, you know, avoid submerging themselves in that dross that follows it. You know, big clubs are already training players on social media, but it still strikes me as strange because most things that elite footballers do kind of on the pitch and off are all done in a kind of risk reward, you know, weighing up formula. And I don't see that the social media, you know, having a social media account, being vocal in a fairly banal way, I don't think that provides enough of a reward to mitigate the risk, quite frankly.
Do you worry as well, maybe, that some of the people who are, you know, tasked with running these things, like having a CEO of media, it goes too far away from the idea of what a football club should be? And I heard Ken Early talk about this quite well on the Second Captains podcast on Monday, sort of this idea, as he said, that Manchester United kind of want to be like Netflix. They want to be a platform through which people can view the latest and greatest, you know, installment of the Cristiano Ronaldo saga or Bruno Fernandes or whatever it might be. But it comes at the expense of what a football club should be about, which is ultimately winning football matches and getting results and all that kind of stuff, where this disconnection that people might already feel because they feel like customers or clients rather than members or supporters, if you like, it just pushes us further and further down that road.
It does. And it actually, you know, on a you know, a very basic level, it goes against the very theme of what social media was intended to be, which was, it was intended to be a medium of connecting famous people and fans of those famous people. And if the famous person isn't sending the tweet, then and this is done, and the Manchester United guy was very explicit that this is why it's done as a marketing strategy, then it does the opposite, to my mind. It actually drives a further wedge between fans and those players, because the only medium on which they felt they had some connection, and look, I understand that the abuse on that medium means that it's become a very toxic place, but it goes against that message, because it says this person is so far away from you that even on a social media platform, they aren't going to be the ones reaching out.
How do you view things like the rise in partnerships with things like cryptocurrencies? We've spoken on this podcast before about Socios, and Arsenal were one of the clubs involved in that. And again, it is marketed as this thing which gives fans the ability to have engagement with their football club, which of course, you know, really isn't true in the sense that nothing meaningful comes from it, but you have to pay good money to get involved with something as trivial as what song is going to be played or what color the corner flags are and things like that. And new technologies, new ways through which fans can be monetized. And I realize football clubs, particularly after what's happened in the last couple of years, are in difficult positions financially and everything else. But the constant search for new ways to exploit fans and to exploit loyalty and love for clubs and players and all that kind of stuff, it seems to be a bit never-ending at this point. Anytime there's anything new, well, that's the thing we can do to squeeze a bit more out of the fans.
Yeah, I mean, 100% agree. It's, you know, fans are customers. That's an unfortunate nature of it, but they're also unique customers in that, you know, if your favourite brand of washing powder either got, you know, failed to perform, failed to clean your clothes, or became double as expensive, or weaponized your customer loyalty, then you would take a different stance. You'd buy another washing powder. Football fans don't have that opportunity. That makes them unique as a customer. And it also creates a responsibility on the part of the company, aka the football club, a corporate social responsibility, not to try and exploit that loyalty. And the reality is, and it's a very sad reality, and it's not just the elite clubs, is that you know, that those football fans are ripe for exploitation and have been exploited to the max. And as you say, not just exploited in very basic terms of rising ticket prices and rising broadcasting, you know, deals, but also clubs constantly seeking for a new way to do that. And while that is incredibly damaging and incredibly dispiriting, it also goes hand in hand with these clubs at the same time proposing and exclaiming that they are a voice of the fans, that they are there for supporters, that supporters matter. You know, you get the sugary cliches of, you know, football is nothing without fans and we couldn't do without you, and managers say, you know, 12th man and all that kind of semi-nonsense. But the bottom line is that is only best represented in how you treat those supporters. And how those supporters are increasingly treated is as cash cows, basically. And cash cows in which their loyalty is used as a weapon against you, because the insinuation, deliberately or otherwise, is you are not a proper fan unless you do this. You know, you are an Arsenal fan, so you must want to be able to choose the colour of the corner flags. And if you don't care, then you're not a proper fan. And we will weaponise other fans against you to make you feel like you're not a proper fan, which is incredibly toxic. And it's happening across the board. It's happening pretty much at every Premier League club, and it's really, really sad.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, there is obviously, people will be screaming at this going, well, you know, there's personal choice and you can do what you want. You don't have to get involved in these things, but they do prey on those very emotive things, like the sense of fan, like the sense of connection. And I think particularly, you know, for fans who might be distant from the clubs, who want to find every way possible that they can be as close to the club or get as close in inverted commas an authentic fan experience as possible. So yeah, we'll have to see how all this plays out and continues to play out across the Premier League. Speaking of which, I want to talk to you about this Premier League season so far. How have you enjoyed it? I mean, we're about what, a little over one third of the way through. How have you found this Premier League season thus far?
I think it's got the makings of an excellent season. It's got the makings of it feels like a kind of fresh spring of a Premier League season after the, you know, the long, fairly hard, fairly bleak winter of 1920 and 2021. Not necessarily that the football was bad and that what happened didn't count, but that we were all getting through a lot of other shit in our lives, and therefore football became this very useful and very valuable distraction. I think this season now it feels as if football is able to stand on its own two feet, not just as a distraction from everything else that's going on, although it remains to be that, but as a fascinating Premier League season in its own right. I came into this season thinking that there would be four clubs that were way ahead of the rest. And after a third of the season, West Ham are a joint second or level on points with second in the league, which gives me, I'm not a West Ham supporter, but it gives me a general sense of slightly disbelieving comfort that maybe money and wage bills and price of squad and everything else and state ownership doesn't mean everything, that there is still a kind of a loophole where, in inverted commas, the magic of sport rushes in and makes hay. So yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed it, I have to say.
Yeah, I was going to ask you sort of what you found the best thing about this season so far, and I was going to maybe suggest that the fact that West Ham are in third place in the Premier League and going very well, I mean, even Arsenal in fifth place is remarkable to me. We have this idea that the clubs who have the money, Chelsea and Manchester City, are going to be miles ahead, and that's not the case at this moment in time. Like, it could happen because those two clubs and maybe Liverpool as well are capable of going on the kind of runs which really open up some distance on the chasing pack, if you like. But the idea, I think, particularly with what's happened with Newcastle and what people see as the inevitability of what Newcastle will become, the idea that the Premier League might actually be genuinely competitive is a heartening one in a way, isn't it? Because it would be just thoroughly depressing. I know it's been the case in the past where there's no competition for the title, or there's such a big gap between one or two or three teams and all the rest. And I do feel like there has been some measure of equalization over the last couple of years in that sense. I don't know that I'd put any money on anyone other than the obvious choices for the title, but we've seen Leicester pretty much stay in the top four two seasons in a row right until the end, until it went wrong for them and they should have been playing Champions League football. West Ham are in the Champions League places right now. It looks like a pretty stern and pretty interesting competition for the top four, and I don't know that I really thought that was going to be possible.
No, and it's done on relatively simple football principles, which at West Ham is to maximise the use of set pieces and hard work, and at Arsenal is to bring through a crop of young players that can add a freshness to a team that was lacking. And the cliche, and I'm probably guilty of saying it as well in the past, is Arsenal need leaders. And yes, fine, that there was a semblance of a point there, but actually, also what teams always need is a fresh start and a fresh mood and a sense that everyone's pulling in the right direction within the same team. And generally, young players are pretty good for that. Their progress is never in a straight line. It's never linear, and there will be setbacks along the way. But at Arsenal in particular, it feels as if there is a blueprint and there are some sustainable steps towards progress that means every defeat doesn't have to mean the cries of crisis, and every victory doesn't have to mean a comeback. It can actually be part of something bigger, of moving forward. And the other thing I'd say in terms of enjoying the Premier League is Manchester United's decline under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, to me, I'm not a Manchester United fan, but it's incredibly frustrating to me that they haven't tried to fix the issue. But it's also reasonably heartening in that a team can buy Cristiano Ronaldo and Rafael Varane and Jadon Sancho and have some of the most brilliant individuals in the world. But unless you have a coach that is capable of knitting things together in a system, it won't guarantee you anything, which for someone that has kind of felt for a long time like one of football's great tenets. Chelsea spent a lot of money, but they had a good coach at the time. Man City spent a lot of money, but they have a good coach. It's heartening to me that the success of the manager is still so very obviously correlated to the success of the team. It isn't just about players.
How much do you think the emotional connection between Manchester United, the club, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the ex-player, for what he did there, has saved him to an extent? Because I do feel like if it were anyone else, and I think we saw something similar with Mourinho, I mean, there was obviously more going on with Mourinho because there always is something going on with Mourinho. But, the kind of run of the form that they've been on, some of the games that they've just about saved that maybe they should have dropped points in or should have been defeated in, you know, they've shown faith in him. And look, that can be rewarded. It's just at various other football clubs, and we saw it recently with Aston Villa, they lose five in a row and they get rid of Dean Smith. Mikel Arteta will be thankful that Arsenal weren't as trigger happy based on what happened last season when Arsenal, I think, went, was it seven games without winning and they lost five of those? You know, they didn't pull the trigger on him, maybe because there was a connection, maybe because he was newer. But with Solskjaer, they seem to have just kind of nailed their colours to that particular mast. They're willing to give him the time, even at the expense of better candidates being available, with Antonio Conte going, "Hi guys, hello, I'm here."
Yeah.
You know, to the point where he went, "Well, fuck it, I'll just go manage Spurs."
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's two kind of separate points there. The first, I think that there is this kind of obvious wave of nostalgia that they want it to work. And I think that speaks to the fact that an acceptance that Solskjaer isn't working there is almost an acceptance of a kind of lack of a unique Manchester Unitedness that they thought they had that would kind of trump everything else, that it would speak louder than Chelsea's spending and it would speak louder than Guardiola's coaching, because there was something inherent that presumably Alex Ferguson instilled in the club that lingered on and therefore could speak louder than even than logic itself. And I think accepting that that hasn't worked is probably, put it this way, I don't think they will replace Solskjaer with another club legend manager, and I'm not sure they'd replace his replacement with one either. So I think there's an acceptance that doing that would end a kind of mini era, even if that era hasn't particularly even been successful. But the great irony of all this is that United are pursuing that kind of vision of nostalgia on the pitch or on the sideline, and yet behind the scenes are attempting to be the most modern of football clubs with their, you know, almost comical sponsorship deals and marketing deals, and their, you know, and even going back to what we said about the guy on the podcast talking about their marketing strategies with players tweeting and on social media, that the two, to my mind, completely strike against each other. That you're pursuing the individually best players in the world, and yet you seem to think that this kind of nod to nostalgia on the touchline is suddenly going to make everything right is, I think, nonsensical. I mean, I think that Solskjaer will leave at the end of the season, if not before, and it might well be the end of the season, so they can make a more long-term appointment. And maybe that's fair enough. But in the meantime, they are risking not being in the Champions League next season. And that's not something that a club of Manchester United size, and, you know, they are very rich. They have huge revenues. They are historically successful. They have been successful in the recent past. But there are no VIP passes to the Champions League. There are no VIP passes to a title race. You get what you put in. And at the moment, United are getting exactly what they deserve.
Well, yeah. And when you consider the amount that they spend and the caliber of the players that they brought in, you know, it does speak perhaps to, like, it's early days with what's happening at Arsenal right now, but there has been a, what appears to me and to many Arsenal fans to have been a coherent recruitment strategy, and that appears to be paying dividends. Whereas if you buy Cristiano Ronaldo simply because Manchester City were going to buy him, not because you necessarily wanted him yourself, that, I think, you reap what you sow to an extent. What's been the worst thing about the Premier League this season?
I mean, the Newcastle takeover is kind of dispiriting to me, maybe in a slightly different sense than with other people, in that it's not the takeover itself, it's not the reaction to the takeover from fans, it's the way that fans are placed in this moral quandary that some choose to engage with and some choose to deliberately avoid, and you know, have their reasons for doing so, I suppose. That it places football supporters who, from everything we've just spoke about, are powerless and are exploited, it then puts them in this position where they are expected to, not unreasonably, to have to make this moral stance on what their club or who their club is owned by. That is incredibly, you know, it's awful. It really is. You know, Newcastle is a club that I have a family connection through grandfathers and mum's side of my family, and I'm glad I'm not a Newcastle fan, because I would hate to have to think yes, how can I weigh up being glad that one owner has left and being worried about one owner coming in? And yet the whole game itself has hardwired me to clamour success and to clamour new signings. And yet at the same time, when we get one of those takeovers that the game and governing bodies allow to happen, I'm then expected to say, well, this is enough is enough. I'm never going to St. James's Park again. There are no easy answers. There is very easy advice, but there are no easy answers. And I just think the game in general should not have put Newcastle United fans in that position. And don't get me wrong, the behaviour of some of them since has been pretty awful and pretty distasteful. But in the main, I think they've been put into a position where is quite frankly scandalous that they were allowed to be in.
Well, yeah, look, it's an issue of governance and how the game is being governed and who the game allows to own football clubs. And that's been an issue for a long time. And it's another way in which fans are kind of exploited is the wrong word, but that sense of loyalty to your club is, you can't just turn that off just because you don't like the owner, or maybe you do like the owner, or maybe you like the idea of the owner, but you don't like the idea of where his money comes from. It is a complicated situation. And there has been a lot of sort of pearl clutching and everything else from certain aspects of it. But I have to agree. I think that has been one of the more difficult parts of this Premier League season. Right, look, just very finally, as somebody who used to do a lot of stuff on Football 365, the winners and losers, in which Arsenal in recent years...
I picked a bad era.
We often appeared in the losers category. How have you viewed what's happened this season, particularly in light of how it all started and where we are now?
I went to the Leicester away game and I walked to that stadium. It isn't just me saying this because I wrote this in the piece afterwards, but I went to the stadium and I thought, do you know what, this is the first time I've come to watch an Arsenal game and I thought, whatever happens today, I think genuinely is a line in the sand, because if they collapse again here and it feels like it's another rolling tide of up and down, and that will still happen, I'm sure. And they were absolutely magnificent. The away fans were brilliant. You've got the status quo, Saka and Smith Rowe song, which feels like an embodiment, like a soundtrack of the club at the moment, in terms of these young, exciting attacking players that are being trusted. They're being started and they're being trusted to carry the club forward and carry the ball forward. And yes, Aaron Ramsdale made some fantastic saves. Of course he did. And he has been a revelation in terms of his personality. But it just felt like a club that finally had control of itself. I've watched Arsenal win games and win games handsomely in the past, but it always kind of felt that results were something that happened to Arsenal more than Arsenal were making them happen. Against Leicester, I got the sense that Arsenal were really making that happen. They decided to start quickly. They then decided to sit back and they decided to soak up pressure, and they did both brilliantly. And it really, I'm a Premier League neutral in that I do not support the Premier League club, and that gives me a really nice position in which I can genuinely take things almost on face value and kind of take delight in a club doing well, even if I have no affiliation. And Arsenal are a club that I enjoy watching at the moment, and it looks like it's a club for the first time in quite a while where pretty much every single player has enjoyed being there. You've got senior players up front who are hounding in possession and trying to win the ball back. You've got Saka and Smith Rowe who are both absolute gems at doing what they do, and not just, it's kind of bigger than itself, because what they're doing is kind of symbolic of this new movement of young players. You've got, I think it's nine, the top youngest nine starting 11s in the Premier League this season are picked by Mikel Arteta, and it seems too simplistic to say, okay, that's what was going wrong all along. But when a year ago we were sat here talking about Willian and the implications of a super agent-led move and a 32-year-old on big money not playing, we have come a long way since then. And Arsenal fans should not necessarily be worried about the future now. And that's a really joyous thing to be able to say.
Yeah, look, I think we will be worried about the future. It'll take a bit more than this. I think there's a natural element of worry, but I think you're right. The difference now between, as you say, the old end of career guys who are kicking around looking for a comfortable place to play out, like Willian, like David Luiz, etc., etc. Some of the other characters who were let go in January who were contributing nothing to this group of young players, you know, a couple of young England stars, Emile Smith Rowe called up to the national team for the first time this week, and deservedly so, Saka part of the squad as well. It feels just markedly different. It's like sort of, I don't know, it's like walking out of your house in the morning and everything's all over the place and coming back and discovering that magic elves have tidied everything up and painted all the rooms, you know?
The best way I can describe it is that if Arsenal lose a home game now, I can imagine that dressing room saying, right, you know what, that was a bad performance, but we will move on from this. This will not kind of taint us and drag us down as it has done in the past. This will not kind of submerge us in this Arsenal ennui, which had happened in the past, and one defeat always brought two or three or four. I think that has changed. You know, the opening run of games this season was worrying, but only because Arsenal were comfortably, Brentford was Brentford, but against Manchester City and Chelsea, it was that Arsenal were worse than elite teams. And the reality is that that is Arsenal's lot at the moment. They have no shortcut to bridging that gap. And you might say it's going to be an impossible gap to bridge given the resources, but that doesn't have to mean crisis anymore. That can mean taking steps to try and bridge that gap through sensible processes that keep fans on board. And the Arsenal fans I speak to now seem kind of almost disbelief in their confidence, which, as you well know, will undoubtedly come crashing down in 3 months' time.
Maybe. I'll tell you what it is, though, Daniel. It football feels kind of like fun again, and it hasn't for a while, for all kinds of reasons, not just because of what's gone on the pitch. It's just been quite fun, and it's been nice to be reminded of that. So, look, we better leave it there. Thank you very much, as always, for your time, and hopefully we can talk again soon.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much to Daniel Story. You can find him on Twitter at DanielStory85, at DanielStory85. And of course, he's the chief football writer for the iPaper.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Now, I told you I would give you the winners of the competition from last week's show to win a copy of the Scouted Football Handbook, which I will do momentarily. Just to remind you that Arsblog has been nominated for Best Fan Media at the 2021 Football Supporters Association Awards. We would very, very much like your vote if you could take 10 seconds or 20 seconds, whatever it takes, to just click on a link and give us your vote. We would be really, really appreciative of that. You will find a link to the voting form in the show notes. So have a look now while you're listening, if you can, if you're walking or sitting. Not if you're driving, please wait till you've pulled over or something like that. You'll find a link. Have a click. There are some other Arsenal people in there you can vote for too, which will be great. Keep it red and white. But if you could vote for Arsblog as best fan media as we try and defend our crown, that would be fantastic. And thank you very much in advance for that. We do have a new edition of the Arsenal Women Arsecast available right now. Tim and Alex are talking to Sky Sports about the deal that they did and the coverage of the Women's Super League. It's a really, really good episode, so make sure you tune in for that. And over on Patreon, we have an episode of Statements, the podcast in which I put statements, funnily enough, to a guest that they have to either strongly agree, disagree, or strongly disagree with. My guest for that one is Clive Palmer, who you'll know from the Arsenal Vision podcast as well. So you can find that at patreon.com/arseblog. Right. The winners of the Scouted Football Competition, I asked you to go to their website and tell me what was the text in white in a red box. The text was New Magazine. The winners were selected by the random number generator, and the three winners are Imran Belim, I think that's how you pronounce it, Giovanni McLeish, and Connor O'Brien. So well done to you guys. I'll be in touch. I'll drop you an email and we will get those prizes sent out to you ASAP. Okay, joining me now on the Arsecast to talk about the Arsene Wenger film and some of the bits and pieces that have emerged from that, it's Philippe Auclair. Hello, Philippe.
Good morning to you, Andrew.
Good morning to you as well. So you've seen the film Arsene Wenger, mm-hmm. Invincible. It's a story we know as Arsenal fans very well. We lived it, we breathed it, we've written the books, we've read the books, we've watched the videos over and over again, and many of those memories and experiences, I think, are indelibly inked upon our memories and our psyches and everything else. So with all that in mind, how did you find the film as a viewing experience with all that, knowledge and experience?
I'd say that, first of all, it was a very pleasant experience and a surprisingly pleasant experience. I was worried that it would be a bit too bombastic, a little bit too hagiographic, a little bit too basically excessive. And it's the very opposite of that. It's actually very balanced, very nuanced, quite subtle. And of course, when it comes to a subject like this one, there's not going to be a big reveal at the end of it. I think we all know how the film ends. Mm-hmm. But obviously, it's how we go there, which is, as they say today, the journey.
Yes.
I'm going to wash my mouth with soap.
There are elements of that journey which I think are slightly surprising in a way, like the bit where, and I mentioned this in the interview I did last week with Gabriel Clark, where they put in the semi-final at Old Trafford, which I genuinely looked at since it happened. I'm still very much in the too soon category for that. But, you know, being reminded of some of the, I guess failings is maybe the right word, but some of the things that didn't quite go as well was an interesting sidebar to the ultimate achievement of going through a season unbeaten.
Yeah, I mean, and to be honest, yes, I remember, you know, there's a moment, or there are moments at which you have got the fixtures and the score lines which are scrolling on the screen. And I was thinking every time, you know, I was a bit like somebody to whom you put a Rorschach test card, because I can remember every single one of those games. I can't remember last week's game, but I can remember those games.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh yes, the 0-0 against Fulham. Oh yes, the 1-1 against Portsmouth, which of course, by the way, is not in the film, which is Bobby Pires's penalty, which is magnificent, of course, as we all know. Mm. You think, well, yes, I mean, and the fact that they have, that Gabriel and Christian Jean-Pierre have actually spent quite a bit of time about that FA Cup game, I think is actually one of the strengths of the film. And the strengths actually come perhaps from unexpected quarters. It's a well-known story. It's a story we all know. But what matters, even if you know the landscape that we are exploring, what matters is the map that is used to explore it, but also the torchlight or the lights which are put focusing on what you're discovering. And that it, I think the tone of it is terrific. And also because more than the story of the Invincible Year, which has been told time and time again, I think it is a genuinely I wouldn't say profound, because it's an adjective I could never use for anything related to Arsène, but it's certainly an in-depth portrait of Arsène Wenger, the like of which I think I haven't seen before, certainly not on the screen.
Yeah, I mean...
And I think that, you know, they spend a lot of time in Alsace, which I think is fantastic, by the way. The scenes there are really, really good. And I hats off to them, because they must have had something like 3 days with Wenger in the hall for the whole shoot. And didn't they use that brilliantly?
Yeah.
They went to all the places. You do get the feeling of loneliness that goes with the management role, but also with the personality of Wenger. You do get the element of fear, the obsession, the humor. You get a lot of sides of his character, which are completely absent from many books which have been devoted to him, for example, including his own.
Mm.
At the same time, revisiting this and other seasons. I mean, there have been some interesting choices made. I mean, we could talk about this for ages, because the only thing that perhaps I would have liked to see more of, but that would have made it a 3-hour documentary,
yeah,
is the fact that the fall from 2004 and basically the Old Trafford game, the Pizzagate game, to the exit was certainly not sudden. There were loads of ups as well as loads of downs. And, you know, the 2006 Champions League campaign was definitely an up for all of us. The 2007-2008 season could have been one of our greatest ever in the history of the club, and wasn't, because Arsenal were just basically kicked from pitch to pitch and had everything against them, as well as a very young squad and all these sort of things. So they decided... And it's an artistic choice, which is perfectly, it's artistic license, perfectly all right, to go straight almost from 2004 to 2017 without going as well through the, devoting some time to the protest, but no time at all for the successes in the FA Cup finals, for example.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, from a fan's point of view. But again, it's artistic license. And what you end up with is a very well-rounded, very nuanced portrait of, well, Arsenal's greatest ever manager with Chapman. So
sure,
that's pretty damn good, actually, in my book.
No, I think
it's beautifully shot, and the music is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Hans Zimmer. It's nice, subtle music, not wistful piano tinkling, noodling in the background. It's much better than that. And there's a great sense of rhythm to the film, which is something that is missing in many documentaries, but not this one. So if I were to to give it a note like you do for our players after every game, you know, and you can reveal, I would give it an 8.5, which is very high.
That is high. That is high. And I'm pretty sure that this is the only Arsenal podcast in which shade has been thrown at Hans Zimmer while talking about Arsène Wenger. So I'm always pleased to have you on, so we get these wonderful moments. Look, I think you're right. You know, it's such a big story, such a long story to tell. You know, where it started going wrong and how it started going wrong and all of that. I think it would have to be a series of some kind. But
yeah, you could say it's almost a different documentary. And we should, by the way, mention the fact that Patrick Vieira is absolutely magnificent in it, I thought.
I thought so. He was my favorite of the talking heads that were in there, because he's not somebody you hear a great deal from usually, particularly when it comes to talking about Arsenal. You know, he's been separated, I think, from the club in a way. And I don't mean that to be critical or anything like that, but he's taken his own path, obviously, to go, you know, via Man City, the City Group, New York to France, back to London with Crystal Palace. But yeah, I found that quite pleasing, actually, the... What's the phrase he uses? I think it's in the trailer. He said, when a manager believes in you, you go to war for him, something like that, you know, and clearly he did on many occasions.
Absolutely. And I think it's the listening to him speak as well. Anyway, because we love Paddy so much. Mm. But you do feel that inner strength when he talks. It's very he's a very impressive and very charismatic man. Mm. And you think, oh my goodness, yes, absolutely. And he's got this glint in his eye and this slight smile when he speaks. I think you're not going to mess around with this guy. Mm. But on the other hand, if you have good times with this man, they were going to be very, very good times indeed.
Sure. Let's just talk a bit about the end of the movie. And again, if people want to wait and see it before they listen to the rest of this, it's not that it contains spoilers necessarily, but there are things that he says and things that we become aware of that we weren't maybe quite as aware of. His uncomfortable demeanor in the tunnel as Bob Wilson is encouraging the crowd to give him the greatest welcome they can on May the 6th, 2018, before the game against Burnley, his final home game in charge, which was an amazing day. I was there. I remember it being a great day. We won 4-5-0, I think, and the reception for Arsene Wenger was really warm and appreciative and... I think from the perspective of somebody in the crowd, it felt great for him. It was obviously a very different experience. He talks about how you're criticized one week and then the next day everybody's really nice to you because this event is taking place. And he talks about, I mean, the thing that really got to me was when he said, now there's no special reason for me to go there. All the rest is just emotional. And I found that you said the word profound. I don't know that I would use that word either, but maybe poignant is a word that I would use, that that he sees no reason to go back to a club where he spent 22 years and dismisses everything else as emotional, when the reason why he should be back and we should want him back and there should be a place for him is because of all the emotion that happened in those 22 years. It's quite sad to see that that's where his mindset is, whether it's self-protection, I'm not quite sure, but I found that quite affecting.
Yes, self-protection without a doubt. You have got, I can't remember who said that, but we don't lead a public life and a private life. We lead three lives: a public life, a private life, and a secret life. Mm. And Arsene is somebody who is incredibly jealous of his secret life and of his private life, both. Mm. And I think that anything which is an intrusion in that is something that bothers him tremendously.
Like he'd be uncomfortable in the situation.
He's extremely uncomfortable. And I actually spoke to him about that 2-3 months ago.
Right.
And we were having a really nice chat and I wanted to talk to him about his time in Japan and so on. And it was great. And but at one point I could feel that he'd had enough. And I said, Arsene, you really don't like talking about yourself. And he said, basically, I hate it. Yes. And he hates being thrown in the limelight. That's partly because of where he comes from, which is not just Alsace, but I would say he comes from the 19th century. It's not because you were born in 1946 that you don't come from the 19th century. He comes from a part of France that was so rural and so backward in some way, which backward, by the way, is a completely wrong word to choose.
I know what you mean, though. Yeah, it took...
It was a place that lived in a different time from the rest of the country. And so... maybe it's his background, maybe it's also the nature of the relationship, which was a soured relationship which he had with the Arsenal hierarchy. I mean, could it be linked to the fact it's a Kroenkes? Probably, because he felt that the Kroenkes, by putting in all these people in charge of, the various teams of analysts and data this and data that they put in place, the way they decided to manage the club is something which was chipping at Arsène's power, whereas he enjoyed a almost completely free hand when David Dean was around. And so you add this, you add that, and also you add the personal dimension of the man. And I've noticed that the emotional is the word that he uses a lot, but he uses it a lot to dismiss it.
Mm.
For example, I mean, he sees that as something, he defines himself in the film, and I'm not really ruining anything because I think it's in the first 5 minutes, as a romantic pragmatist, which is as good a definition of his approach to football as well as a pragmatist romantic.
Yeah.
But he talks about, the need not to go emotional. And to take an example, which is perhaps not as blessed as what we're referring to, recently, when talking to Rio Ferdinand about the biennial World Cup, he said that the opposition to the plan was mostly emotional.
Yeah.
As if it was a dismissal, whereas perhaps, given we're talking about football, it's probably the most important of all reasons. So that gives you an inkling as to where he is, I think. I don't think being Arsene Wenger is necessarily a very pleasant thing all of the time.
I sort of got that sense, like I looked at it and thought, I'm not sure I would like it. Like the obsession part of the obsession with football, something that perhaps during his time as manager, people said he is obsessed with football. He goes home, he sits down, he watches three matches, he stays up till 3 a.m, then he's out and he goes to training, he's at the training. And I'm thinking, like, there is a work-life balance thing that's probably healthy and one that is unhealthy. And I wonder, you know, do we maybe look at somebody who is the way Arsene Wenger is, maybe sometimes, and think, wow, that's really admirable, when in fact, it's probably not. And I don't mean that to be necessarily critical. He is who he is, and that's the way he operated. And,
exactly.
You know, to get to the very top of an elite sport or any elite pursuit, you probably have to be dedicated at the cost of other things. But I got a sense from the film, not just about, he wasn't very specific about this when he talked about maybe his personal life or his family life, but he was a bit more wistful when he talked about some of his football life. So I'm assuming it would apply to that, where he talks about, I should have gone somewhere else. I should have done things differently.
Yeah.
I maybe, you know, some recognition of the fact that the way he wasn't necessarily the best way to be, even if he couldn't say that in so many words.
Mm. It's a very melancholy film, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think as well, all of us would have heard him saying how much he regretted that his obsession made him a very selfish man, and how it made him, I would say neglect, it's not quite the word, but and his family became really second to his obsession in his life. And it's something that he said for a very long time. And we've come to accept it as, yeah, he would say that. But when he says that in the film, it really hit me, actually. That, yeah, actually, that's what you did. You sacrificed your family life, but you sacrificed it not because you had to go down the pit to provide bread and put it on the table. You sacrificed it for selfish reasons.
Mm.
And I think he finds it very difficult to live with that. And when he's talking about it in the film, the regret is not feigned at all. The regret is something he feels quite deeply. But that means, I mean, all we're saying right now, I think, is the best possible advertisement for the documentary. Because if you can put all these things across, suggest them, which is also another great strength of it, which is things are not shouted in your face. They're suggested.
Mm.
You're treated as an intelligent spectator who is able to understand what is going on, and who is sharing in a lot of what is going on. And it confirms, I have to say, Andrew, a lot of what I've been thinking and writing about Arsène, and I'm writing about Arsène for all these years, is that he's one of the most misconceived people that I can think of. And, because his monk-like life was not so monk-like either. We shouldn't think that that's the only thing he was doing.
Mm.
But unlike Sir Alex Ferguson, who, by the way, is also excellent in the film. And we have to appreciate the fact that he agreed to appear in it. And Ferguson always knew to take the time off. He knew when to cut off. He knew when to delegate. He knew when to keep out of things. He knew when to get in back in them. And as a result, has had a life that I think most of us, despite the fact that we probably wouldn't want to be Manchester United managers, can look at and think, well, it's a life I wouldn't have minded living.
Sure.
Because there's a bit of everything in there.
Yeah. I mean,
just with Arsenal, it's a bit, you know, apart from the fact that it's Arsenal, which of course changes rather a lot of things.
Yeah.
It's not quite the same.
No, just sort of finally, because I know you're pressed for time, but I do want to ask you about this. I mean, there is probably a line between obsession and ego and self-belief and talent and ability and all of those things, which I think are evident within Arsene Wenger. And we have this situation right now where he has not been back at the club since 2018. And I think we can all understand to an extent why that might be. You know, that there are perhaps good reasons why you don't want to have a manager, a manager like Arsene Wenger there looming over a new man, a club that's in rebuilding mode or all of those things. I mean, we can see reasons as to why that might be the case. But we're now heading up on 3 years, 4 years since he's been back. Mikel Arteta spoke about this and was pictured with Arsene Wenger at the premiere. And he said, I'd like him to be more present at the club. I think the players will love him. They will benefit. They will be inspired to have him around. I think for the club, it would be a huge boost. It would be so beneficial for all parties to have him more present. And that is the first time anybody at Arsenal has really spoken about Arsene Wenger in those terms and spoken about rebuilding a relationship, which is clearly very damaged. And I think it's sad that it's damaged. I don't know whether Arsene feels, you know, maybe some of the people at executive level who he didn't appreciate are gone now, but maybe some of them are still there. The owners, of course, are still there as well. Yeah. I don't know if his problem is necessarily with them. I don't know if his problem is that his departure happened or whether it's how it happened or maybe a combination of all of those things. But it does feel a bit like the longer it goes on, the more difficult it will be to ever make it right. Sort of like if you have a slight falling out with somebody and then you just leave it for ages and ages and then it just becomes impossible to mend fences. So I'm glad to hear Mikel Arteta talk about it, but how open do you think Arsene will be to the idea of even just returning for a game, to be there to watch the team, which is not something he has been able to do since 2018?
To go back for one game, I think yes, absolutely. I think he would be open for that. That would have to be a special occasion. But I'm sure there would be plenty of special occasions to celebrate. It's not as if milestones are hard to find on the calendar year for him, for his Arsenal. Otherwise, I think no chance. First of all, he's now very much involved in his work at FIFA, for better or for worse. And as an advisor to IFAB as well, he was elected to a position, not on the council, of course, but as an advisor recently. The first thing is also he's getting on a bit. So I think he wants to spend time with the people he wants to spend time with. And what's wrong with that? Also, I think he would be very ill at ease to become this kind of either the nice uncle whom you revere, but which you put in his, in the Diamond Club. I don't think that's him at all. He's still a man of action and so forth. You would think, well, I don't think it will necessarily bring back great memories. And especially the Emirates for him is not a place that means an awful lot. That's clear as well. Highbury is a different thing altogether. Highbury for him is synonymous with the years where things were looking up all the time. The Emirates is the symbol of something completely different. Could he come back with any responsibility within the team? I don't think that's possible because he would have to be in charge of everything or nothing. So, yes, it's sad. And also, he doesn't wield within the club any kind of influence. Again, I will take the example of Alex Ferguson, whom you see at Old Trafford, and he's still, you know, part of the infrastructure of the club in many ways. He still wields a lot of influence, and people will still defer to him. Now, people would defer to Arsene Wenger as far as we are concerned, but certainly not in the boardroom. So when you put all these things together, and he's genuine, and he's not somebody who likes to be in the limelight, even if he's very good when he's in the limelight. He doesn't particularly enjoy it. He just as much as he enjoyed addressing a room full of small holders, shareholders at the Arsenal AGM, because in a way he could assert his power on them through his charm. It's a different thing as to being subjected to people wanting to have their picture taken with you every 5 seconds, or your autograph, or this and that, or you know. And it's not an. It's not. These are not things that he's, you know, he's looking for. Yeah, that he's searching for, or that he's ever enjoyed. And I was also struck by one thing. You know, when he says in the film, as years went on, the media demands became larger and larger and bigger and bigger, and I found them difficult to deal with. Yeah. Well, Arsene was doing 3 times more media work at the beginning than he was doing at the end. At the end, he wasn't doing any. What had changed was his, I'm well placed to say that. He had become impossible to contact. He had become impossible to get on for a one-to-one interview. What he was doing, though, is that he was spending a lot of time doing stuff for Bein Sport or TF1, which he was paid for, which he assimilated to media work. Do you see what I mean?
And
so his perception changed, and I think his persona changed. He became harder, tougher than he was. And I don't think that would be necessarily a good idea. And I can perfectly see where, you know, Mikel Arteta is speaking from, and it's totally sincere, obviously. And I'm sure that if he came into the dressing room after a game, which we've won, of course, it would be wonderful. But other than that, I mean, apart from a special celebration, perhaps for what do we have coming? Well, to be honest, that there was the anniversary of his. I mean, everything is going to be a fifth or a tenth or something like that, kind of jubilee-like. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't.
I'm sure we could find one, but there will be occasions at which it would be possible to invite him in.
But even just attending a game and being there again, I think would be enough just to see what happens after that. I think you're right. You know, you can't make him technical director. You can't make him ceremonial, whatever. None of those things are particularly beneficial. But I think even just some kind of informal.
Keeper of Stan Kroenke's swans.
One of those. It would be nice, I think, for that barrier to be broken down. But it's a fascinating subject, this, and we could probably talk about it for ages and ages, but we can't this morning because you have to go. So I'm going to let you go, and thank you very much indeed for your time. Just before you go, you do have a gig coming up in London. If you want to tell people when that is and how they can get tickets, that would be great.
Yes, under my name of Louis Philippe, I'll be playing at the Lexington, quite a lovely place near King's Cross, actually, in London, on Sunday, the 28th of November. And there are a few tickets. I'm playing in Paris this weekend, and that's sold out. But we've got a concert coming at the Lexington then on 20th of November. And if you just put Lexington, 28th November, Louis Philippe and the Night Mail, you'll find us. I think we're on C tickets, and we got tickets, and all these agencies, which take far more money out of the events than we do. But there you go. We've got to use them. So
sure.
Yes, please come round and say hello. And though there will be one football song performed on the night, and I can't tell you which one, it will have nothing to do with Arsenal and Arsene Wenger.
Okay, perfect. We'll add some links into the show notes as well, so people can just click through in their app and find tickets if they want to go along to that. Philippe, as ever, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
As always, great to talk to Philippe. And, you know, I think we probably could have spent another good while having that conversation and talking about all the various aspects of Arsene Wenger and what's going on and what isn't going on with him. But maybe we'll save that for another day. Remember, you can follow Philippe on Twitter @PhilippeAuclair. So, for now, let's leave it there. It is an interlull after all. Hopefully you've enjoyed the show. Thank you for being here all the way to the end. Thanks for listening, downloading, sharing, and all the rest. Do give us a review on iTunes or the Apple Podcast app or whatever the fuck it's called now. Reviews are good. We like them, particularly if they're 5 stars. So if you could do that, that'd be great. If you can't, don't worry about it. James and I will be here on Monday. We will have an Arscast Extra for you. For now, though, have yourselves a great weekend. And we will talk to you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye. Twice a day, we look at what's happening with the players. We look at the data. We take the data and the data, and then we look at the narrative that's surrounding that particular player or issue, and then we can change that narrative with the data and the data via our social media channels. Of course, we can do it now on the blockchain. We've got players all over that blockchain, man. I mean, they're blocking up the blockchain, if you know what I mean. There's so many of them on there. Crypto, of course, is hugely important. And ultimately, we'll be able to change the stories because football is changing, you know? Now you're kind of tied to what's going on in the real world, but as soon as we start working in the metaverse, Liverpool can beat Manchester United 5-0 at Old Trafford in the real world, but in the metaverse, we can make that whatever we want. What is the metaverse? I don't really know beyond some desperate attempt by Facebook to save itself from irrelevancy because, frankly, the whole platform is a dumpster fire. But this is what I'm working at here as the CEO of Narrative at www.manchesterunited.com/Manchester United. Download our app for free. You can have your club with you wherever you go. We'll be with you wherever you go. Tracking you, taking your data and your data, serving you ads, monetizing your fan experience, investing in Bitcoin and Tesla shares. You did what? Oh, fuck.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.